Yeah, you also got to understand where that demand is coming from. So it's driven off modelling to reach a certain temperature change by 2050. Right? It's all back calculated from there. I think in reality, the pessimist in me says there's a lot of work to get done to even see that demand.
I'm so glad you're talking about this. No one ever asked the question, will that demand actually occur? Like, demand doesn't come from having a target. Correct. You know what I mean? Like,
correct. The pessimist in me says they'll both grow at deflated rates. And
underrated, overrated?
Cobar as a region for copper.
Overrated?
Financing a project where the debt comes from a commodity trader.
Overrated?
G'day, Money Miners. Today is... well, I think it's Friday. We pre-recorded it. I'm hoping to upload it Friday, but we might be uploading it Wednesday, depending how bloody busy we are at iMarkJD. So I'm just going to refrain. I'm going to leave it open.
That's it. Date unknown. But what I do know is we have an exciting chat about copper to share. All things copper, really.
This is a funny one, isn't it? It was a really interesting chat that we had. Of course, this chat came about by the fact that Maddie went and bought a banh mi at the front of Let's Eat, buddy. And of course, half of the time that Maddie has a great conversation standing there, and this was with a former colleague of his back when he was working at Sandfire, but it is with a copper market expert who understands all of the nuance of that copper market from from the miner's perspective, but what actually happens to that product? What do those market dynamics look like? How do the commodity traders interface with it? What are the financing dynamics?
That's it. The conversation took a bit of a twist. I didn't totally see it going. Got into the ins and outs of the smelting and refinery and all that sort of stuff. I mean, it really put me on a bit of a tangent on the weekend, getting more into the details. I found it, you know, a sort of interesting starting point personally to learn more about that world. And Benny Hooper, the guest, like you said, Sandfire experience, has also worked at BHB, Western Mining, Evolution and Glencore. So he's been around a few operations and a few, you know, bigger shops, as it were. And yeah, he's got a wealth of experience. I found particularly interesting the chats in and around the commodity traders, their roles in, you know, being the middlemen essentially between the miners, the smaller miners, the various terms, the onerous terms that they put on. And then the end use, which is the, you know, the copper that wires up the world. So it's an interesting chat.
Understanding how those commodity traders interface with the miners is something we're going to explore more and more.
Yeah.
We're pretty interested in understanding it. It's kind of, being in Perth, it's a part of the industry that is kind of not, there's not much going on here from a commodity trader perspective. But it's a huge part of the industry and it impacts the companies that we do talk about. And thankfully, Ben explores that in this conversation, plus wicked overrated, underrated as well, mate. So really keen to talk about that. Also, very keen to talk about the fact that we've got a new sponsor today, JD.
Yeah, and the middleman is a great segue. now that it sort of comes to mind, we're keen to announce our new sponsor, Brooks Airways. So how it relates to middlemen, these guys have a growing fleet, actually. They've got a bunch of, you know, jets that are nine-seaters, rather. They've got some smaller ones. They've just got a new 19-seater as well. So the fleet is growing. They're, you know, primed to service the goldfields, the southwest, in and around. You know, if you're going to Cowal, if you're going to Wiluna, if you're going to the Murchison.
Anywhere across the state.
That's it. And you can get in touch with Stu Brooks and cut out the middleman, and you get a far better rate.
This is something I learned in our conversation with Stu. We grabbed a beer with him last Friday, and I didn't quite understand. So, if a mining company, you know, needs an ad hoc flight here or there, what do they generally do? Well, they'll contact a broker. So it's like a plane broker, a flight broker, and a broker, goes across to the different charter services out there and sources that way. Mate, middlemen, take a bloody clip. Ignore that. Go straight to Stuart Brooks. They've been doing this for 20 years. The brand Brooks Airways is the new brand that they're rolling with. But these guys have been doing this for a long time. And Stuart himself, mate, he was repairing planes at the age of 13. Like, he was literally slave labor, a child prodigy, literally. Look, understanding the mechanics of planes at the age of 13, and now he's a plane, a flight aviation entrepreneur.
He is. And just like you said, Matt, that word of airplane flight brokerage, I had no idea. So we're learning every day at Money of Mine. And yeah, Stu, really appreciate you coming on, sponsoring us. And if you are an explorer, a mid-sized market, a large miner out there, you're in the goldfields, get in touch with Stu. If you're getting, analysts, if you want to get people out, just get in touch.
Get it? Yeah, absolutely. If you, there's a whole bunch of reasons you need flights on a regular basis. These guys do it. They've got wicked fleet that can get you there. And if I was going to fly somewhere, mate, I'd want to choose a plane that is run by the child prodigy, Stuart Brooks, who's been on the tools at the age of 13, figuring out how this stuff worked. I would do that.
Love it. get into the description. Click on Brooks if you're interested and take it from there, guys. Thanks a bunch for sponsoring.
Wicked. All right, mate, to our great conversation.
With Benny Hooper. Here we go.
Righto, money miners, you want some copper. Jesus Christ, haven't we got some copper for you today? Now, this chat come about after a bit of a barn me waiting area side chat at the Let's Eat Lunch Bar. My good old friend Benny Hooper from Sandfire rocked up and started getting into, copper metal, copper concentrate, how it works around the global markets, the role of Trafigura, Glencore, and in that 10-minute chat, I'm like, we've got to get him on. And here he is, Benny Hooper, head of sales for Sandfire. Is that your bloody, isn't it?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mate, congratulations on such a nice title, mate. Welcome to Money of Mine.
Thank you. Yeah, it's great to be here. That chat only went for 2 minutes, not 10. So maybe it's just the volume of information you received.
Yeah, 10 minutes worth of knowledge crammed into two. So Money Miners, what we are about to deliver in an hour is pretty much the Encyclopedia Britannica.
I'm pretty sure that most of the people that Matty's like, we've got to interview this person, come about from a conversation out the front of Let's Eat Lunch. Right? So it's a bit of a bloody strategy for people who want to be on the show.
You want to be on
the
show?
Just hang out the front of the Bar Me place.
Buy me a roll. And yeah, sweet. Mate, Benny, your history, mate. You've been Sandfire, Glencore, BHP, Evolution, in and around a lot of copper, mate. Did I miss any there?
No, that covers most of them. Not primarily copper, but certainly nickel and a little bit of gold as well.
Any favourites?
Oh, copper's a great industry to be in, of course.
Good answer for the SFR share price there, mate. Right, boys, let's map out this episode before we get into it.
Let's do it. We're gonna cover a heap of ground with Ben here. So I reckon the natural place to sort of start, supply demand, see how things are shaping up, because we're here with every bloody fundy we talk to, that the copper price is going through the roof. But I've been hearing that for 2 years now and nothing's happened.
There's a supply gap.
That's it. Yeah. It's coming. Yeah. And then,
seven escondidas. Yeah.
And then you've got the commodity traders, which we're sort of intrigued and, we're fascinated by what their sort of role is, how they carve out more than just a margin, sort of being the middleman in all of these transactions. As well as a bit of a price bifurcation and, a bit of copper M&A, downside risk to the thesis. I think we're all going to get it in here. But like I sort of said, I want to start with supply and demand. And I want to hear from you, Ben. When is this big tick up in the copper price going to happen?
Maybe that should have been the last question.
Yeah. It'll set the tone, I reckon.
Set the tone.
Yeah, I think you're doing pretty well to predict where metal prices are really going, certainly in the short term. I suppose from a supply-demand perspective, we're looking at metals kicking off in 25, but much as yourself, we've been hearing this rhetoric for the last 24 months and it's pushing out. Certainly in the near term, metal prices are reflecting a downturn in consumption. So we're seeing fairly deflated prices. We all hope that this is near the bottom. But I think the next 18 months are going to be fairly challenging for producers and metal prices.
When it was about $4 a pound, Ben, was everyone saying, was Sandfire saying, this feels like the bottom now, but it sort of kept going?
I wouldn't have thought so. I think the long-term prospects are always there, but there's I'm no macro economist, but the global economy is driving a lot of these sentimental positions and underlying them, the fundamental positions for the pricing mechanisms. So
can we talk about what those drivers are? So, like, if you were to kind of categorise the key drivers of the demand side of car park. You've got Chinese growth, residential growth is at like the, you know, first and foremost at the top of the short term demand list.
Well, historically, the Chinese infrastructure, the Chinese housing market's been the primary growth profile for copper. Infrastructure also sits there as they're putting in, you know, nice copper cable to tie in what would ultimately be renewable energies. And obviously the renewable energy itself is part of where that consumption's going. So I think the recent information coming out is that, you know, the Chinese housing market hasn't really moved, which was expected. But coming out of the Chinese New Year earlier this year, we have seen above expectation growth in terms of their infrastructure consumption and their manufacturing consumption, which in reality is putting those transitional energy items onto the global market, and they're being consumed externally. So the Chinese exports from a copper manufacturing perspective are fairly positive as well. So though there's been a downturn in the traditional housing market consumption, those other two areas have picked up a little bit. But that's talking China. I think when you look on a global perspective, the American or the US economy is on teetering on where it needs to be. I think the next few months will probably be pivotal in where we see the US, but the European market's probably in more dire situation where, you know, their manufacturing is really quite down and energy prices are high. So thus the where we're sitting over the next 18 months is really dependent on how those economies are looking.
And all this is, you know, obviously very, very sort of short-term thinking. Does that really impact how you look at the longer-term play of copper at all?
Personally, I'm a copper bull. Yes, I think
you
the
would
stories,
be given you work the in stories. A
yeah, but look, you've got to be a realist as well. So you've got to deal in the now. But copper has the potential to meet all the expectations that people are saying if we're to achieve our carbon emission footprint and the, you know, the target in terms of greenhouse gas temperature reductions and through to 2050. So there's other factors at play that can change that, because there's a natural cap on where you see something like copper, because there's natural substitution, there's recycling, there's thrifting in the industry. So all of these things come into consideration of where that maximum price is. There's different investigative bodies that will give varying prices, but all of them longer term are positive. It's just getting through this short term, medium term period.
So looking at supply now, so copper price sitting in US dollar per tonne, $8,500 to $9,000 at the moment.
It was only $7,900 the other week, wasn't it?
Yeah, look, I'll take that price.
And, you know, on a per pound basis, I think $3.57 I'd seen. So over the past, you know, 24, 12 months or so, that price hanging around this sort of level hasn't been enough to incentivize a massive amount of supply. We've seen, you know, some green lights at Rio Tinto and Kennecott and those sorts of things. But it seems quite clear that these prices aren't enough to really kick on a huge amount of supply. Like, to start with, do you think that's pretty fair to say?
Yeah, but copper supply or any mining supply is sort of longer term. So we're looking at, you know, mines coming into, or greenfields at least, mines coming into production have been utilising prices 5 years ago. On average, the large copper mines that people say are turning on, you know, they're big investments that take a long time to come on board. On top of that, you've got a declining grade profile. The mineralogy becomes more complex, and there really just aren't the operations coming on board at the current, or even, you know, where we were 2 years ago, that pricing position. So on top of what we're talking about before in terms of the supply-demand position, we need the copper price to go up a fair bit to incentivise that supply gap to be reduced over the next decade. And I say decade because that's how long it's going to take to realistically get these operations up and running and that metal units into the world profile.
The coming supply gap, not the existing one,
by the way. Yeah. I think the role of, like, especially probably on the smaller end, if we're looking at ASX, it's the role of the zinc price as well, with a lot of polymetallic operations that are copper and zinc, because the zinc price is so poor, it's, you know, whether it doesn't matter what the copper is, if they're not making bugger all out of the zinc. And then you've obviously, well, Mount Isa kept their zinc open, didn't they? They just shut the copper down, which was
that's right. bad
for the industry.
But now sort of looking at supply to sort of jurisdictional way, where do you see sort of the growth coming from? I think I saw that Chile produces 27%, you know, here in Australia, 4%. Obviously, De Grasso we touched on has come offline and stuff. So Australia is, you know, only a small player. So you really look at Chile and Africa, the Zambias, the Botswanas, the Congos of the world. Where do you see the biggest reaction in supply coming from in the next 10 years?
That's pretty much where I'd see it as well. You know, South America is the logical place to bring on more, dare I say it, lower grade copper porphyries. Mm. And I think balanced with growing ESG positions across global companies, Africa will be tackled, albeit at a different rate. But I think there's potential in Africa to see more copper units coming out of there.
I think it's interesting some of the copper that's going to be coming out of Chile. Like, remember when they were talking about Escondida's grade was, you know, starting to reduce and it was like 0.7. It went down to 0.7 something. I was looking at a project the other day. I think it was a solvent extraction Electra winning one. But like their resource is like 0.4%. Like, these are what these new projects that are going to be coming on in Chile. Like, that's what, like 0.7 is actually really good.
That's right. And they're all, you know, big capital investments for essentially brownfields operations. So there's not a lot of greenfields coming on. And like you say, if they are, they're quite low grade. So,
and so a lot of these operations have had pretty severe disruptions over the past year or so. So Escondida, you know, really across the world, you know, even in Australia, the smaller operations, Capricorn Copper, Ernest Henry, across the entire globe, there's been disruptions in the copper market in a supply sense, as well as, you know, increased capex. Do you look at that as a sort of
increased or decreased capex?
Increased capex,
right?
Cost of capex or the amount of capex spent?
Well, I thought Codelco were really winding back their capital spent to.
Yes, but the capex that needs to go into the projects is jumping.
Yes, the capex required to sustain production.
Yes,
but capex actually sunk is being
okay. Yeah, yeah. So spent money reducing.
Yeah.
Money needing to be spent in the future.
Yeah.
Going up. Do you sort of look at that as a bit of an anomalous year, or do you think that's a part of a trend that's going to continue in that direction, Ben?
Annually, the researchers will provide us with a supply disruption breakdown, and I would think that there's nothing unusual about a recent history. It is a percentage of production that we assume will have, you know, not come onto the market for a range of reasons, and I expect that will continue. In terms of whether the trend increases over the coming years, I'm not quite sure. Yeah.
And then there's this other sort of big, you know, potential mover of supply in 20 years that we keep hearing about, and that's
see now.
Recycling and the impact that recycling is going to make to the market. And you're even hearing people say it's going to be an infinite loop in the future, a long way down the track. I'm pretty new to this all, but what sort of impact does recycling currently make to the copper market, and what are the sort of consensus opinions of where that sits in 10 years, 20 years?
My granddad would fill in his spare time by stripping old copper wire and going and trading it in for money. So, mate, it's here now. The recyclers are doing their job.
Yeah, we don't need to open the mines, so we can stop the conversation.
One of my neighbours up the road is actually works at a copper recycling joint.
Mate,
the price of that Voltaire got to be in and out. Got to get it out in 2 days. Take it in, get it out. Yeah, mate.
Yeah, I think you're half on the money there, Matty. I think it's really slim margins for the people actually doing the work. So in theory,
and risk,
it makes
and
sense.
A risk of holding it because of the price fluctuation by the sounds.
Yeah, and it does fluctuate depending on how the market's sitting, because it is cheaper to bring in new metal units than recycled metal units. But no, we can draw on something like lead that has really high, I think they're plus 50% recycling in lead consumption. So there is hope there, I think, for any commodity. Copper has a life cycle, as do most metals, but depending on the demand in a certain era, decade, and the life cycle of that copper, you'll see fluctuations of that material coming back to the market. I suppose I'm trying to think, cobalt, for example, in the initial EV batteries was quite high. You know, as time's going on, the cobalt component in EV batteries is dwindling. So the earlier batteries, when they reach the end of their life cycle, a large amount of cobalt will come in versus those batteries that are in consumption now, you know. So I think copper on a broader macro scale will follow a similar trend, but it's not a new process for copper, and smelters are slowly taking the initiative, particularly the European smelters, to bring on larger components of recycled copper into their primary feed stream. But it is a slow process to move these metal units into the existing circuits.
So you set a sort of 50% number for lead there. Can you give us an indication of what that looks like for copper at the moment?
It'd be a guess. It's less than 5% or something like that, I think.
Yeah, wow. Okay.
Ben, the part of the copper market I'm super curious in is the interface that the copper producers, the miners, have with the intermediaries, the commodity traders and the likes. And we spend all our day talking about the producers in this world. A lot of them have kind of subscale mines, and in order to get their mine finance, they've got to do a deal with one of these commodity traders. They're one of the only financiers that sort of plays ball and kind of often get screwed on terms in the process of trying to get the money in the door. I guess I just, you know, you've had the purview of sitting inside a copper producer for the last 10 years. What is, like, how do you interact with these commodity traders? Like, you know, what are your interactions with them? What are they trying to achieve? How do they achieve it? And where does that product bloody go?
Yeah, we're all in business together, right? So I mean, you should always aim for a win-win relationship, in my perspective. I think ultimately the traders, the intermediaries, are very good at their job, and their job is to make money. They're not miners. So you try and tackle any relationship as you would, any working relationship as you would. So personally, we try and maintain relationships with all, you know, tier one traders.
What are the tier one traders? Is that Glencore, Trafigura?
Yeah, flag them all as you go along.
Are they the only two tier ones, or are there other ones?
There's other global traders that move copper around the world. Transamine, MRI.
Yeah.
You've got Japanese traders, Mitsubishi RTM. Concord stepped in. You've got Hartree stepped up. Concord, I think I might have mentioned. A range of difference. You've got Blending House, Ocean Partners do blending. So there's a broad range of these companies can offer to put product at various locations around the world for you.
So when you go to this, when you went to that LME conference in London the other week, who's more in demand? You've got so many of these traders coming to you to try and secure Sandfire's copper supply for them.
Yeah,
is there shitloads of them?
Yeah.
Just hammering you all the time?
Copper's a very liquid commodity, right? So, and very low entries of barriers of entry into the trading game. You've got to have lines of finance, and there's a lot of people with a lot of money around the world. So, in essence, yes, but that's their job, right?
Yeah.
I might work in sales, but I'm not having to sell something. I'm having to appropriately sell something.
What does that mean?
Managing the risk of a sale more so than marketing a product for sale. I think even in a supply deficit environment, a commodity is still sought after because there's money to be made by moving product around the world and distributing to smelters. And coming back to your original question, you know, producers should try and build relationships directly with smelters as well, because they're ultimately the user of your product. And, where do you stop? You know, you spoke about lithium a bit earlier offline. The producers have direct relationships with the end users of lithium products. So it's just how does a party add value within that sale process, from getting it out of the ground to end user?
And so when you're talking to a smelter, is a lot of that around spec of the copper, of the concentrate?
Or? Well, ultimately, it's always nice to have some direct sales with smelters as well, because you can have those frank discussions. In reality, smelters are bound by their own operational constraints. So ultimately, we want to be able to provide them with something that fits within their smelting, feed grade capacity.
Yep.
There's various import requirements around the world, and there's various product handling requirements around the world as well. So Europe, for example, the smelters can only handle a certain amount of tonnage of lead. So even if they're to blend things out, if they increase their lead in feed, they increase their lead in tailings, and that can, or their slag, and that can ultimately reduce their capacity, because once they've hit that lead level, that's it.
And what are some of the other parts of the spec that go into that whole mix and match, and where you're going to send it? Like, lead's one of them. What are some of the other ones?
Oh, I think if you were to use the Chinese import quality as a guide, things like arsenic are up there, bismuth, antimony, mercury, chlorine, and top of my head, fluorine perhaps.
Yeah, they all sound pretty shit, don't they? Yeah, you all know they're bad.
Is it?
Like, except antimony, because you make money in gold.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. So these traders, they'll structure a deal with you, the producer. What are the terms of these deals look like? Like, what are they specifying, and in what ways are kind of, might the unsophisticated negotiator get caught up by the ways that commodity traders negotiate?
Just bring it up on your phone if you want, mate. And we'll throw it on camera.
There's a range of, like any contract, there's a range of positions that each party can take. I think those unexpected producers often get caught out because of the timing of when an offer might be put in front of them. Sometimes juniors are requiring cheap cash, which the traders might offer versus a bank. A bank might, for a feasibility study, require a offtake agreement to be put in place to provide debt funding. So if the timing's right for a trader to step into a junior, they've probably got the upper hand from that perspective in putting forward their terms. Depending on depending on where you're at as an operation and the maturity of the business, you get more leverage against the trader. So there's certainly some traps, but their business is to make money. And I think I mentioned again offline that sometimes there's a winner, sometimes there's a loser, and that works from the global copper perspective. So one of the things that ultimately boils down to payment is the treatment charge and the refining charge deductions that come out of a copper sale, and it's similar for other base metals. The benchmark is an annual process established between essentially a large miner. Generally in the last couple of years it's been Freeport, Antofagasta have tackled it. You've got other big producers in South America that also trade or own smelters, so they're staying out of it. The BHPs, the Anglo-Americans of the world, Glencore stay out of it. So the mining groups will then try and establish this treatment charge and refining charge benchmark with the Chinese smelting purchasing team. So it's the agglomerate of the tier one smelters in China. So they try and work out what is a good price for the industry. And that sets the starting point, I suppose, for negotiations. And a lot of earlier contracts might say, we'll sell to benchmark terms. That looks pretty good to an outsider, but you might have a quality that is desirable to a specific group of smelters where you'll get a deduction from that benchmark. So this year, the benchmark's $88 per tonne of treatment, for example.
Per tonne of concentrate?
Per tonne of concentrate.
Or contained metal?
That's the treatment charge, and then the refining charge is the refining charge of copper pounds of copper.
Yeah.
If the quality turns out to be good, then the trader who's picked up that offtake, gets a discount, could be $10, $20 on that benchmark.
Oh, so the trader gets that.
Because the producers signed a contract that says, well, we'll sell at benchmark terms. And that's the a major one, but there's other elements to it. I think a review internally in my company before I started, there was something like 150 points of interest that a trader would look to negotiate for a discharge port settlement shipment. So there's lots of ways you can move around protecting yourself as a producer. One of them is to bring commercial settlement back to, you know, your home location, be it mine gate or load port or something like that. And then you've got all the elements around assays and quality and loopholes of, and the like, penalty adjustments for those bits and pieces.
What are the big penalty adjustments?
Well, we spoke about the elements before.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like, the mining contractors that have the day works book.
Yeah, yeah.
They've got the schedule of rates, but like, oh, here's some day works.
Correct.
For some extra shit we did yesterday.
Yeah.
Sounds like day works.
It's the same framework under a different contract, right? It's like, well, we paid you to do a job, but then you came up with these extra jobs, so we have to pay you for them as well. But I'm still paying you for the time you're supposed to do your other job, even though you did these other jobs.
Yeah.
So the quality argument's the same. Is, you know, you've got a quality and you say, well, place this on the market and give me a price. And they say, well, here's the price, but here's the extra takeaways I'm going to take. Here's the extra deductions. And you say, well, did you place this quality on the market? Yes. I said, well, why am I paying you more deductions if you went to the market? You know, if I sold you apples and you said to the market, I'm going to give you apples, and I give you apples, you get paid for apples. You don't get paid for oranges, you know?
Why do you have to use I just don't understand the world very well, because I've never interfaced with commodity traders and everything. But it appears to me, when I understand this business, and this business has minted like so many billionaires, they clearly make enormous margins. And I think, well, how do you make – at whose expense do you make this enormous margin? Well, it's got to be the producers, you know what I mean? So, like, you know, all of the commodity traders out there who are minting it, they don't actually take on the risk, because they'll lock in the price and they have the ability to do that, but they can mint a massive margin. Why do you need them?
Or is it because the industry's so, like, big, like, for what they've got to do? They just direct a bit of shit.
Good traders will have a back-to-back contract and take no risk, right? Yeah. Why wouldn't you? Take a slim margin on the volume. That's why they all move large volumes. The place they have in the market, I suppose, is building those relationships between producer and smelter. And I'm talking copper and base metals primarily. Coming back to Glencore and Trafigura, for example, in the zinc lead space, they own their own smelters. So there's a leverage position that they have in buying those concentrates and moving their product through to their own smelters, or distributing them elsewhere if they see value in moving them elsewhere. I think it's a protection position as well. Again, depending on what your commitments are and how your contracts are written. For example, if I had a position with a smelter and wasn't able to deliver, then that erodes a lot of value fairly quickly. Whereas a trader, for example, can pull a parcel from another producer and deliver in that spot for you,
yep,
and manage that risk. That's their argument anyway.
how does the whole the difference in supply and demand and price work for copper metal and copper concentrate? There, from what you explained to me before, it's two different sets of cases.
Yeah, it's an interesting perspective, because as a base metal producer, we sell metal units, you know, but we physically sell metal concentrate. So the treatment charge and refining charge is where it comes into play, because we are selling concentrate and someone needs to spend the money, someone needs to spend the capital on building a smelter to then have operational costs to treat my process, and that margin is fairly slim. So as a producer in the copper market, you can get paid for a good percentage of the metal that you're passing through. So, you know, smelting and refining might only get 4-5% of that metal value of copper as it goes through the refining processes. So,
and how do those TCRC, those charges tend to vary over time? Like, what are the key drivers into that 4-5% moving over time? Is it capacity at these smelters to be able to take your product, or is there other drivers I might not be thinking of that lead to the change in their margin?
The supply-demand we spoke about on a copper perspective ties into the concentrate side of things, you know. So if there's a certain amount of smelter capacity built around the world, And if there's not enough concentrate to fill those smelters, some of those smelters are running short, and therefore they start giving you better terms to take your concentrate. And that's where you'll see that treatment and refining charge drop below what would be a normal average. Currently we're sitting about what we'd think is a normal average.
On these traders we talk about, we hear Trafigura, we hear Glencore, you rattled off a few names then. Who's the biggest, who does what, who specialises where? If we let's talk copper.
Have you the book The World for Sale?
Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah. Look, Glencore were the group, right? And then they listed, and you know they've probably regret opening up what was a very in-house process. But they've also moved with the times, right? I think they understand that they're operating in a world that's different. These companies started off by having, you know, let's call it insider information, but they had information and technologies that at the time enabled them to have an edge over everyone else, you know, governments included. I think in the current era of information availability, these traders have probably moved down that path as well. But in terms of copper space, you've got Codelco, and they're a big company. But in terms of trading space, you know, Trafigura is probably the number one copper mover.
And what's copper in relation to their whole business for trading? Like you were hearing their nickel offtakes with IGO and everything. Like, is copper a big part of it? Or just everything?
I think their metals, metals trading group accounts for about 20% of their revenue.
Oh wow!
The energy side is 80%.
Yeah,
and then their metal side. You know, copper's fairly big in it, but you know, they dabble.
And you can see as well, I mean, the margins have gone out of the commodity trading business. They wind slower over time. Even Glencore, they own so many mines now. That's not something, you know, Mark Rich and Co. would have done in the 80s.
Yep. And
because what
that
was
came
their
about,
first thing was when they bought, was it Xstrata, when Xstrata got
2011
bought the, or yeah, well, technically yeah,
they
rebranded
kicked off,
to
kicked off Xstrata.
Yeah, that was their first presence.
But I mean, they're very innovative. They're good at their jobs. You know, they're productive businesses, and they do what they need to do to keep that cash flow going. I think the margins are slimmer because the world's changing.
Yeah,
they're not getting those Mark Rich deals anymore.
Yeah, it's more transparency.
Correct, yeah. And you know we're all dealing with you know modern ESG to operate. It's you can't hide behind closed doors anymore.
And those other names you've rattled off, the other traders, are there traders in the commodity copper in the copper market that have little niche roles? How do the smaller
for sure.
ones function?
So China's such a big market, as we were talking about earlier. So some of them will only deal with China. Others will have relationships with various smelters around the world. You've got the owner operators like Glencore we mentioned before, BHP, Rio Tinto, Codelco. You know, there's a lot of movement within these internal groups. Within their own businesses, but I think each trader, you know, if they're doing the right thing, they'll all bring something different to the table. They all try and make money via those 150 odd mechanisms I spoke about earlier, but ultimately it comes down to their financing position and the relationships they have. So if they've got a good negotiation on a contract into, you know, smelters in Japan, for example, then they know where they can push the producer to, and they get cheap funding. You know, the world's not what it was 3 years ago. We're all paying a fortune in interest as we move metal units around the world, and the banks are benefiting from that. So, you know, cheap funding adds to it. So those who have got a bit of cash, or you know, private cash or institution cash. Can make a bit more money than those who are borrowing from banks, for example. But I mean, something we didn't touch on before when I talk about interest rates, you know, the global stockpiles are reducing because people can't afford to hold on to metal units in inventory. So, you know, we talk about the supply stockpiles on the LME or the SHFE are, you know, as low as they've ever been. It's because that no one wants to pay for something and not use it. It's not because there's necessarily a supply shortage. It's just that it's the natural place that it goes to in high interest rate environments, and we're all to transact and borrow cash, even if it's for a X month period on a sale, it's costing money.
Yeah, right. That's interesting.
And people often point to these low inventories at LME or, you know, the Shanghai and so on as an indication that, oh, the copper price is going to go on a tear. But I've also heard that looking at inventories isn't perhaps as insightful for various reasons as it was 20-odd years ago. Can you shed a bit more colour on what the world of inventories looks like?
Yeah, I think a very small portion actually goes onto these into these warehouses. Right? Yeah. So the role that it played historically is, you know, I needed some copper for some, make some tubing. I go to the warehouse, I buy it and I take it to my factory and I make copper tubing. This day and age, I think there's a lot of forward movements that the product doesn't even see the warehouses. So it's business as usual, as opposed to putting them in these warehouses for sale. And coupled with the higher interest rate position we're seeing now is there's no real desire to hold stock. Someone's paying for that stock to sit there.
Yeah.
And the processing of copper, it actually looks pretty different to a lot of the other metals, the base metals and stuff that we talk about quite frequently, in that there is a Chinese dominance to it. I think 40% roughly from memory is done in China. But, you know, rare earths, graphite, we're talking 80, 90% of the processing being done in country. So, I mean, to start with, where are the rest of the smelters sort of geographically spread?
Like most smelters, you need a reasonable power supply. Obviously, we've got two systems in Australia, in the Isa region and the Olympic Dam region. The Indonesian government, you're probably aware that, you know, they're putting mandates out for a lot of in-country processes. So they're building copper smelters.
Just like they did with nickel?
Yep.
And then Scandinavia, from memory, has a few with the hydropower sources.
Yeah,
there's
a couple of there's a copper and a poly smelter.
How about Chile? Given that so much of the production comes from there, rather than shipping so much, given you're trimming a lot of the weight before, if you were to do it in country, is there a lot done there?
No. So I suppose there's economic reasons why it's not done there, for whatever reason. It hasn't occurred to any large scale.
And with a lot of the other commodities I touched on before, there's a huge push to move that processing away from China. You've got the IRA being, you know, incentivizing all these companies to build downstream in America and friendly countries. What's the sort of rhetoric like, more specific to the copper market? Is there that same push to build ex-China processing?
China is king in copper. They have the capacity to just keep building. Like I was saying before, they consume more than 50% of the world's copper and they're generating the products to sell to the rest of the world. I think most commodities are in there, and perhaps the marketing of other industries kicking off in the Americas and Europe is, in my opinion, fairly in their infancy. China are in a key position to step forward in the green energy transition, and I'd say they're the only nation to do so, and they hold sway in most commodity sectors. There's a lot to do in the Western countries to catch up.
So given the way you've sort of worded that, we've had these conversations about metal price bifurcation quite a bit in the past couple of weeks.
And it's our go-to now.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a pretty divisive topic, you know. You got on the one hand,
it's a bifurcating topic.
Oh, there you go. So on the one hand, you got the real believers, and that could be for different reasons. Maybe they think, you know, ethically it should be the case, or maybe their interests lie, as they are a mining company, that should be the case. And then you got the ones on the other hand saying kind of what you're saying, like it's Chinese dominated and that's not changing for a long time. I get the sort of feeling you're leaning more into the latter camp there, that like China has too much of a foothold in this market.
I'll just butt in with one thing. Had a bit of feedback from someone I might have played golf with the other day, and they're like, ask Rusty if he wants to pay an extra 5% for every capital raise he participates in. Anyway, continue
That is a good point, Matt. That is spot on. I think last year at a conference I attended, that question was put to the market.
Yeah.
And no one put their hand up.
I think in Rusty's defence, he was advocating that the government mandate it, not that the consumer chooses to do it.
But the consumer has to pay eventually. Yeah.
And they are. Governments are starting to mandate it. Yeah. Yeah, it's a really interesting topic because we all intend to do the right thing for the future. And in China's defence, I believe they're also making those transitions, and they'll do it in their way. Certainly, there is an appearance that there's in the copper market, at least, that there's two markets at play. As a producer, we're yet to see value in a premium in selling into a market that is going to cover off future emissions or green credentials. There is the International Copper Association has a program called the Copper Mark that's a range of smelting groups and ultimately OEMs are signing up to. A few producers are getting there.
The very first time, now that I'm thinking about it, that I heard about price bifurcation was Robert Friedland pounding the table like he likes to do, saying that the 4 or 5% copper that he mines in the Congo shouldn't be priced the same as the 0.5% stuff that you see coming out of Chile.
So he's going the other way.
Because of the energy intensity needed to mine the stuff. So that's the fight amongst all the other fights that he rages on about. So a little bit on that one.
Yeah.
But, fight fire with fire there by the sounds.
Yeah. I think some of the IRA incentives don't kick in until next year from memory. So to the extent you'll see like a sliding scale like worked on in terms of the tax credit available to buyers of EVs, maybe the premium emerges when those incentives sort of
It'll through. Happen at some point, right? It has to, but at this point in time we haven't yet seen it.
Was Todd Milan mentioned a very slight premium on stamped copper, didn't he, Jade?
He did, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they...
Yeah.
I can't remember if it was Codelco or Freeport that he mentioned.
What's stamped copper?
Literally, they were stamping it to signal the traceability of the product.
Yep.
Yeah.
It was mentioned as very, very minor.
But certainly the European smelters are pushing hard to have it. The Japanese smelters are pushing hard to have that branding.
Yeah, Bellevue are chucking lime cordial in their gold, so it comes out green.
Why don't we talk a bit about copper M&A? So we've spoken a shitload about lithium M&A lately, but you know, reflecting on the last 24 months, there's actually been quite a bit in the copper space from BHP and Oz, from Sandfire buying the asset in Matsa, Hudbay buying Copper Mountain. There's been quite a bit. Do you get the sense that a lot of the majors are kind of content with their positions now, or do you see that there's going to be, you know, before this sort of new higher incentivizing price, a lot more M&A done?
I think the price is probably the kicker at the moment, because ultimately someone's got to fund that and approve the funding for that M&A decision. So if there's opportunities there, any producer would be taking them right now. And there's obviously a reason they're not, but I think any copper producer is bullish on copper, and if there's an opportunity there, they'd be taking it up.
Do you think BHP would have got Oz Minerals a lot cheaper if they waited a year? Do you think they would have with the decline in prices?
I mean, they picked it when the share price had more than halved already, is when they made the bid.
Yeah, yeah. You're
easy
right.
In hindsight, but it looked pretty good at the time, I suppose.
Yeah,
and then they get to... bring forward some of the synergistic opportunities as well.
Bearing in mind that China had been in COVID lockdown for 3 years or something like that, so it wasn't until end of January this year that the world was expecting China to open up and boom. So timing-wise, you know, they thought, well, we've got to get in now because March 23 is going to kick off.
Yeah,
That's where all the medium-term forecasts were at the time.
I think they paid a good price, to be honest, fellas.
Mm. Yeah. And, I mean, beyond just the majors looking at scooping up copper assets or the copper miners specifically, even Barrick earlier this year were rumoured to have...
They bid First Quantum.
First Quantum for $23 billion from a gold company, so...
They're not the only gold company out there hunting for copper. That's an extraordinary theme to be witnessing.
Like, that's exactly it. I think if there's copper assets to buy and producers are keen... They'll be bought. So
by the gold companies, not the buddy.
So they've still got assets to buy, for sure.
The gold the gold majors are having an identity crisis. You know what I mean? Like, imagine being Barrick, right? Like the world's most recognisable gold name, and you're out there bidding First Quantum. Yeah. Like, what an identity crisis.
They need to get on board.
Yeah, well, they are Barrick Gold.
Yeah. I'll be rebranding. Barrick Battery Metal soon or something.
Barrick Battery Metals. That actually doesn't sound too bad, actually, Trav.
I want to sort of, you know, touch on the idea that the bullish thesis could be wrong, given it's taken a while to play out, and just perhaps to play devil's advocate for a moment. Like we sort of said at the beginning of the show, everyone's bullish on this thing. Robert Friedland, the man himself, banging the table saying we need whatever the number is, three times as much copper that's ever been mined to be mined in the next 25 years.
Sounds like Jerry Harvey.
Would you put any weight into the idea that, I don't know, supply could match demand growth over the future, that perhaps tech advancements could be made so batteries are far less energy, you know, they can use, you know, less copper for the same amount of energy output?
And brownfields projects could just have expansion done to them to produce more throughput. Like, that's the trend as well. Yeah, just to your thing.
Yeah, I'm not sure if there's a rounded question there. It's just putting the thoughts out. Do you think there's any sort of, you know, weight to that thesis at all?
Coming from a copper bull.
Well, you've got to
be frank with yourself. So.
You've also got to understand where that demand is coming from. So it's driven off modelling to reach a certain temperature change by 2050, right? It's all back calculated from there. I think in reality, the pessimist in me says there's a lot of work to get done to meet that, well, to even see that demand. So we need manufacturing to kick off to see this demand, because it's all about power infrastructure, renewable energies, EVs, right? So all of those industries need to grow. Then those markets need to grow themselves, and then the supplier then needs to match it, to match the pricing. So I think...
I'm so glad you're talking about this point.
The pessimist in me says they'll both grow at deflated rates, and we'll see a temperature increase as predicted, right? I think it's a good impetus and a good starting point to drive that change. But ultimately, like the rest of the world, when is this trigger happening? The industries need to kick off. China's the only one making these renewable energy transition products, and the rest of the world's just buying them. Are we just going to keep doing that? Because that doesn't change anything.
Yeah, it's. I always found it really staggering how everyone that talks about how many mines are needed, they start with the climate targets, and then they back solve the copper requirement or the battery metals requirement. But no one ever asked the question, will that demand actually occur? Like, demand doesn't come from having a target. You know what I mean? Like,
I did say once, we could be in a bubble right now. You'd never know. Imagine if the EV thing was a bubble. When we talk copper mines and we're talking Escondida, as we talked about De Grosse at the start, you're probably well over the different types of copper out there. Every copper mine is not the same. And I might flick this back to the start, but what are the different types of copper mines around the world by styles? And if you can say for each style, probably the capital required for them and the difficulty to find them, and like which are the ones the best ones to find. We'll start at De Grosse. That's one of the greatest copper discoveries. So De Grosse, a via volcanic massive sulfide deposit, very high grade, but you just can't find another one.
we'll take 10 more of them for sure. But like most things, it's a balance of everything out there. You know, you've got your copper porphyries, as you say, in South America. You've got your primary copper operations. We spoke about Africa have a really potentially high return on copper investments. The Kamoa-Kakula product is high grade, right? It's a different mineralogy. Africa seems to have a slightly different mineralogy than what we're seeing around the world. So
it's not a VMS, is it? What type of deposit is it?
Sedimentary hosted.
There you go.
Ah, right. But it's still 5% copper, isn't it?
Yep.
It's very high, isn't it? Yeah.
And it's a low sulfur, so it's a chalcocite-rich deposit, yep. I'm led to believe. And the Central African operations are generally of a similar nature. And, you know, you've got polymetallics spotted all around the world as well. So each of you need all of them to come into play to meet the demand. I think the certain businesses will buy certain deposits if they're available, and you know they've got to meet the expectation of whatever buyer is out there. You know, the bigger companies in South America are probably going to continue buying those operations.
So, Mateo, what style's that?
I haven't got into the geology for it, but I'm led to believe it's a similar style to Southern African deposits.
Yeah, and but it's funny when we talk about De Grosse, what that was. De Grosse produced pretty much would have produced 50% more copper than Mateo is going to produce, but Mateo has to process three times as many tons.
And it's still considered a high-grade operation.
Yeah,
so it's
exactly.
Crazy.
It shows like a 5% copper ore body how phenomenal something like that was.
Yep.
And that's what, like, you know, you see, even though CSA is very deep, I'm not too up on the grades there, but that's like, at one stage, CSA was one of the highest grade copper mines in the world.
Yeah.
It's just bloody 1.8 Ks underground.
Correct, but you talk about assets and copper units, they're just pin drops in the ocean of the amount of copper that's currently consumed and how much we're expecting to consume. So, you know, there are big changes if we're to meet this future supply gap to bring on a lot of operations.
Oh, and like just the scale of these Chilean deposits. So, you know, well, De Grosse was 65,000 tonnes of copper per annum. Escondida produces, I think it was at 1.4. I think it's reduced a bit, but it was used to produce 1.4 million tonnes of copper. So from a sub 1% ore body.
Yeah, the scale is massive. Kolwezi as well, Kalama, there's a number of them. And then, you know, hopefully a few upcoming as well. We spoke with the guys at Filo, and there's a number of operations in and around there as well that in future could add significant amounts. Granted, you know, very significant amounts of capex need to be put in to get those ones online.
Yeah. So like when you're sort of floating around this non-porphyry space, like when you're looking for, like, you know, these sedimentary deposits or those Southern Africa sort of things, is that a good sort of area to target in terms of the fact that if you go down a porphyry route, that is like billions and billions and billions of dollars of capex to, and it's only the majors that can do it. Is that a pretty highly competitive area for targeting copper projects?
Again, I think it comes down to which company owns the reserve or asset and what they're looking for. Yeah, small companies, you're going to struggle to get capital to build one of these low-grade deposits into an operation. A lot easier to get something started that's low capital. But it's all needed at this point.
It's such a scale game. Like the history is riddled with the pitfalls of being a small scale copper miner. Very few have sort of done that and kept afloat over the long term. Sandfire obviously benefited from the good stuff, mate, the sugar. But if you look around, right, like, it's been a hard slog for the subscale copper miner in history.
Yeah, and I think it comes down to some of the earlier commentary around where you're getting your funding from and what offtake agreements you have around and paying off debt and the like, because, you know, if you've got an offtake agreement structured around debt, it does add an extra layer of complexity around your cash position and where you sit through the life of mine.
Ben, I'm keen to wrap up. We're just going to wing an overrated, underrated, very focused on your purview of the copper world.
Mm-hmm. Can you do an underrated, overrated?
We'll keep it broad.
I'll see how it goes.
Can't say.
Underrated, overrated. Financing a project where the debt comes from a commodity trader. Underrated, overrated?
Overrated.
Cobar as a region for copper.
Overrated.
Ooh. What about South 32's commitment to get a larger copper portfolio?
Underrated.
Sounds like Brendan Harris is your new boss.
I'm sure there's going to be no comment.
I loved you all right on the line there, Trav. I like it, mate.
I can't think of any
The IRA for the impact that's going to have on base metals.
Overrated. I'll go overrated.
Filo Mining.
What's that one, Matty?
Filo mining, the one in on the border of Argentina and Chile?
I don't know. No comment on that one.
Yeah, they're fucking looking at
it. That's a straight back.
Having a Perth office, but no assets in Australia.
Well, I'm still living the dream. Aren't
I? Underrated, I'll take that.
Oh, I love it. Oh, I'm stumped.
That's been fun.
No, that's been bloody sensational.
We didn't even get to rip into Maddie.
Yeah.
What do you want to know?
The stage is yours.
Ben and Maddie used to work together back in the day.
Yeah, I know, when I was snotty nosed. Bloody know-it-all. Second gig. This is after Paulson's, yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Shout out to Tony Syme, my bloody, the man that fathered me through it. What a bloody GC.
Tony, yes.
Absolute legend. Mate, thanks so much for coming on. That was very insightful. I can't wait to listen back to it, actually.
Yeah, rubbish.
And take it all in. So I'll gather we... bloody ticked off most of the boxes there, mate.
Yeah, look, we touched on it fairly broadly, which is good. Always happy to talk more over a bun, me.
Yeah, and I think isn't people like you with, you know, knowledge in niche things like that? Once you feel like finding someone that's will listen to everything you say, it's probably pretty flattering, eh?
It is. It's a surprisingly small industry, right? And you don't hear a lot of this stuff. Like I said, off to LME, and there's producers don't often go to these things, and I think I didn't know too many people there, and you just realise how big the industry is, and they're all trying to write their little questions down and get their answers in, and it's as free as information is, there's a lot of information out there on each commodity and how the global markets work for each commodity.
Yeah.
No, we'll chuck an LME site visit onto the round the world trip we got planned.
Yeah, absolutely. No, chuck some sponsorship on from LME too. That'd be all right.
Yeah, I think Matt Chamberlain, the chair from LME, is over in a couple of weeks. You'll have to hit him up.
Come on
get
in,
get
Matty,
him on. We'll get him on in.
Mate, we'll shout your beer, mate. It's on me. Right, Benny, cheers, mate. You have a good weekend. And
cheers, Ben.
Legend, Ben.
Thank you.
There we go, mate. All things copper with Benny Hooper. That was, like I said at the beginning, that was really fascinating. It put me on a bit of a tangent over the weekend to learn more about the ins and outs of, you know, the various characters along the way, from supply, from copper in the ground, all the way to the end use. So I learned a lot from that. And
I feel like we just touched the surface
in some ways. Yeah, scratching the itch, mate.
But a wicked preview to, I think, some of the content that will ultimately come as commodity traders start talking to us.
We'll wear them down, mate. On that note, let's thank a couple of our sponsors.
So, we got so many of them now, mate.
At the beginning of the show, we had a new one, Brooks Airways. Thanks a bunch for coming on board, guys. We've also got Futureproof.
ACA, Terra, JP Search, Anytime Exploration, KDrill, SMEC, and MMTS.
Yeah, really appreciate the support, guys. Hoodaroo.
Hoodaroo.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.